The next presenters will be Ms. Lara Barazi Yerolanos from Greece. She will present responding to market requirements and challenges, making aquaculture a competitive food producing sector for the benefit of world consumers. Ms. Lara Barazi Yerolanos is Chief Executive Officer of Kefalonia Fisheries, the oldest farm in Greece and the first Greek organic producer. She studied development, economic, and finance in the U.S. at Columbia and Harvard University. Ms. Barazi is the current chairman of the Marketing Commission of Federation of European Aquaculture Producers, as well as Federation of Greek Mariculture. Welcome, Ms. Lara Barazi.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. I'm the last speaker of the day, and I think you must all be a little bit tired. And I also realize that you've probably been hearing a little bit about the same things when we talk about sustainability, but I'll try to say something fresh. First of all, I would really like to thank the organizers for inviting me to speak today. It's really a pleasure and a great honor for me to be here. I was asked to come here and speak to you as a farmer, not as an academic or a marketer. I am neither of those. About my experience competing in a difficult market. Whatever I learned about marketing came through trial and error, but I would have saved myself a lot of time and effort had I known or applied some of these principles that I will describe a little bit further on, earlier on. So the subject of this plenary lecture and thematic session, responding to market demands and challenges, is particularly relevant in light of the global economic crisis, which has forced us to reevaluate our understanding of free markets, the role of government intervention, and the dangers of a completely unregulated system. The old philosophical divide between monetarist and Keynesian, liberal and conservative, interventionist and free market, is simplistic and increasingly irrelevant in today's complex world. What the experience of recent years has shown, though, is that development in an unsustainable manner is sure to have catastrophic results in the long run. So sustainable aquaculture, what do we usually mean when we talk about that? We usually mean environmental sustainability. And while it's clear these are very serious concerns, they're also very real and quantifiable and scientifically reliable solutions to these issues. For an industry to be truly sustainable, it has to be also economically viable as well as socially acceptable. We know that this relationship is not a static balance between conflicting goals, but it's a dynamic mode of behavior whose challenge is to continuously adapt to changing conditions. So what affects economic sustainability in our industry? Well, the economic viability of any enterprise is dependent upon many factors: good planning and budgeting, adequate financing, well-trained and motivated personnel, a cost-effective and productive activity. In short, good management, something that can neither be mandated nor imposed, and nor should we try if we believe that the free market is the best judge of sound management. The aquaculture industry, however, is characterized in its mature phase by an apparent endemic cyclicality, which goes beyond good or bad management and affects both good companies and bad. Examples in the salmon industry, Pangasius industry, sea bass and sea bream abound. These boom and bust cycles have especially disruptive economic and social repercussions: job losses, loss of investor confidence, and stakeholder credibility. They impair the ability and motivation of companies to address environmental and social concerns. A company in financial difficulties can rarely afford to be conscious of environmental issues. The worst effect of all, perhaps, is that the struggle for day-to-day survival, economic survival, can result in a short-term mentality, which then carries over even in the good times. So what is the cyclicality? In essence, it's a market issue. The most well-managed, competitive, aggressive, and innovative company will fail if it produces something the market doesn't want, in the wrong form, at the wrong price, or in the wrong quantities. Understanding the market, therefore, and responding to it is essential to the economic viability of any activity. I would like to take you through some of the factors that affect competitiveness and success in the market for aquaculture products, the challenges that are faced, and maybe some solutions. To understand the market, we will examine existing and potential demand and supply, our customers, their needs, and finally briefly go through some of the more significant contemporary market trends and perceptions. Let's take a look at the macro level. We have the following trends. We have a growing population, per capita income and household purchasing power, growing animal protein consumption, and add to this a growing awareness of the health benefits of seafood combined with a relatively low average per capita seafood consumption on a global level. We have stagnating capture fishery landings, and aquaculture now provides more than half of global seafood consumption. In other words, in just over 20 years, aquaculture contribution to per capita seafood consumption increased by an impressive 235%. The general trends in our industry are fantastic. Industry of the future, growing population, growing income and purchasing power, more and more educated and concerned about healthy eating, eating more and more seafood, and with a finite source of wild fish on the other side. Magic formula for an ever-growing demand. Slightly more detailed analysis might ask two vital questions. What happens in the short and medium term? Aquaculture, yes, but what kind? What does the market want, and are we in a position to provide it in the long run? Where is the growth occurring exactly, and who is well positioned to take advantage of it? Let's look at competition. At the local or national level, aquaculture products often compete against imported products. Within the wider aquatic food market, the competition might be between farmed and wild-caught, and often is also between fresh versus frozen, whole versus processed, value-added, and so on. At a higher level, our products compete within the global food market against all other protein sources, the old fish versus fowl debate, and ultimately our products compete against all alternative food offerings, and the battlefield is the entire food market. So whose attention are we competing for? It's very important not to confuse our customers with our consumers. They're both important, but with distinctly different needs, wants, perceptions, and roles. The obvious customer is the final product consumer, but it's also the primary household purchaser who may not have the same needs, wants, and perceptions of the product. To reach these two groups of consumers, a product has to go through a retailer, possibly through a wholesaler. It may reach the consumer through the HoReCa sector, hotel, restaurant, and catering, or through the processing industry. This last group are actually our customers, but they're not necessarily our consumers. And in all of these cases, there's a close and dynamic relationship between these two groups, as the needs, wants, perceptions, and roles of the one affect directly or indirectly the needs, wants, perceptions, and roles of the other. In general, our consumers require easy access to the product, affordable prices, product safety, and increasingly production methods that are environmentally friendly. Finally, also quality. I have it in brackets because what is meant by quality is not always clear, even in the mind of the consumer. On the other side, the business customers require competitive prices. They have managed to assume very high bargaining power, constant and regular supplies, logistics, consistent quality, not necessarily high quality, and again, lately, they want their suppliers to comply with certain environmental and social responsibility requirements. There's a very important distinction to be made between the consumer and the customer. They have different needs, and it's increasingly unclear whose needs, in fact, drive the market. What is clear is that our relationship as producers is almost entirely with our customers and not with our consumers. The givens that we know is that large retailers are continuously increasing their market share and gaining more power vis-à-vis the producers. There's an increasing demand for added value, ease of use, fish food products. And there's a growing importance of the hotel, restaurant, and catering sector. On the consumer side, people are more and more concerned with being healthy and eating in a healthful manner. They're concerned about the environmental effects of our production methods. And of course, they have quality concerns about quality and food safety. To complicate matters further, consumers within the wider market for food are far from homogeneous. There are many characteristics which can help to further identify our consumer base and their needs. One part of market segmentation is demographic. And then within the demographics, there are differentiating factors within that. Whatever the specifics of a consumer group, there's almost unanimous agreement on the need for labels that inform and certifications that reassure. Food safety and quality are among the highest ranked concerns among seafood consumers. And apart from the legally compulsory information that have to be on a label, a product may have one or more specific labels that have to do with the quality of the product, environmental or social impact of the production process, and any other characteristic that might appeal to one or more consumer groups, organic, eco-friendly, and so on. It is, in effect, a way to differentiate one's product. Now, I very briefly mentioned some of these elements that are useful in understanding the market and that need to be considered when devising a marketing strategy. Most of these points will be covered in much greater depth in tomorrow's thematic sessions. What I would like to do is talk a little bit about the theory behind the market in general, because it may help to explain the cyclicality of commodity industries, such as aquaculture, and offers insight into some solutions. Going back to basic economic theory, the quantity demanded is defined as the various quantities that consumers are able and willing to buy at various prices. When all other factors that affect consumer behavior are held constant. It's not unreasonable to say that for the most part, aquaculture industry tends to move up and down along this curve. As supply increases, prices fall and more quantities are sold. There are two basic problems with this. The first is that there is a limit to how much fish can be sold, no matter how low the price gets. And the second is that the only way to move back up the curve to higher, more viable prices is to reduce quantities. So the challenge is not just to increase the quantity demanded at a given price, but to increase demand at every price. Changing any factor that affects consumer behavior will cause a shift in the curve itself, an increase or decrease in demand for every single price point. Why is this important? Well, not having good and timely data on the market, in other words, about where this curve actually is, simply leads companies and producers to keep moving down along the curve until they reach the price point at which demand will equal their supply. Again, this is not bad in and of itself. If it's accompanied by ever-decreasing costs, so in other words, increasing productivity, and therefore equal or maybe even greater profitability, or if it's part of a strategy to price out competitors of the market, either through a better cost structure again or better financing for a short-term strategy. Another element to keep in mind is price elasticity. Price is often mentioned as the primary deciding factor in seafood purchasing decisions in surveys. But a market strategy which is only based on price reduction can be disastrous in the long run. And this helps explain why. Price elasticity of the demand curve we saw earlier is the degree to which the quantity demanded will change given a change in market price. And it's not the same at all points of the demand curve. In other words, at high prices, the quantity demanded is very responsive to price changes. If prices go up and are too high, demand will shift to a substitute product. Conversely, if prices go down somewhat, then the percentage change in quantity demanded will be greater than the percentage change in price. It's more sensitive at the upper part of the curve. So what happens as we move down the curve? At the lower end of the curve for a normal good, the price elasticity of demand will become more inelastic, which means that a further decrease in price, will result in a smaller proportionate increase in the quantity demanded. And there is a point at which no matter how much price decreases, demand will not increase. Maintaining artificially low prices, by artificially I mean unsuitable and unsustainable in the long run, can lead to a shift in perception of the product from a superior to an inferior good. And I mean that in an economic definition of the word. An inferior good being one whose demand will go down with increases in income. It's essentially perceived as being of lesser status in consumers' eyes. In other words, it may facilitate the entry in the market of substitutes who in fact have very different cost structures and perhaps other advantages in presentation, cooking convenience, and so on, that are all of a sudden requirements for your own product. If we take the example of the sea bass and sea bream industry, it can be argued that we have lost the opportunity to build an added value market for our products since we have been competing for market share only on price. If the consumer cannot differentiate between our fish and a nice, white, inexpensive fillet of pangasius from Vietnam, why should he buy a sea bream fillet at twice the price? This is a snapshot of my industry, the sea bass and sea bream production in the Mediterranean, and it illustrates the point quite clearly. In the last 20 years, production rose from 10,000 tons to over 250,000 tons annually. And ex-farm prices dropped by 76%. More importantly, for the last 3 years, they have been below production cost, and farmers have been selling below production cost, essentially. Knowing that our markets in the whole continue to face a deficit in seafood supply, why is this happening? Why did this happen? Increased demand can only occur with a rightward shift in the curve. We mentioned this earlier. A change in product attributes, form, added value, or perceived benefit. Our products, at the initial stages of the industry's development, were presented like this. Fresh, whole, on ice. After the first and second price crises in the 1990s, products entered the market like this. And today, after our third price crisis, they reach the market like this. For almost a quarter of a century, and at times of fast market changes and fierce global competition, the main presentation form of the product has not changed at all. A product is a set of characteristics, essentially, whether it's actual or perceived. And each characteristic appeals or satisfies the needs of one or more consumer groups. Obviously, modification of a product is often easier than modification of consumer needs and requirements. The salmon industry presents a very good example of this. Started off whole, fresh, sliced, certified and labeled, filleted, marinated, pre-cooked, smoked, and I could go on and on and on. So essentially, there are two directions, two strategies, and both are equally valid. You can produce a mass market product and compete only on price, but that requires the appropriate technology, cost structure and sale methods, mass production equals mass sales, or a focus on a higher end market, which requires important investments in quality, targeted marketing and customer service, and changes in logistics and distributions. These higher costs have to be justified by a clear understanding of the targeted market, its size, characteristics, and growth potential. Regardless of which strategy one chooses, information is key. On the demand side, this means access to data on the market, consumers and their preferences. And on the supply side, it means data on production volumes, both at a company and industry level, production costs. These are important pieces of information that are very often lacking in aquaculture. And of course, the ability to analyze all of this and use this information in a timely manner. The reality, though, is that most farmers, and this includes large companies, generally face a commodity market where they have little bargaining power to negotiate prices or transaction terms and are far removed from their final consumer. Ours is, to a very great extent, a commodity market. It's dominated by small to medium-sized family enterprises with limited resources to invest in promotion of their products. On the buying side, the market is dominated by a few very large retail chains with demands for compliance to their own quality labels while paying ever-decreasing prices that are not passed on to the consumers very often. And in general, there have been few collective marketing efforts to promote the health and nutritional benefits to consumers. So what are possible solutions? Concentration, certainly. Since the early 1980s, global agriculture industry as a whole, and livestock production in particular, has been marked by a great degree of concentration. The same trend has occurred in the wholesaling and retailing sector. Production concentration can lead to greater market stability and therefore sustainability, but only if it leads to greater cost efficiency, better production planning, in other words, production that's better coordinated with demand, and better negotiation power vis-à-vis the market channels. The same effect can also be achieved through cooperation. Producers' organizations and cooperatives have been successful in some cases by allowing farmers to pool sales and input purchases, to jointly promote their products, establish a quality brand, and invest in the joint production of added value products. They are essentially a means of achieving concentration of the offer without financial consolidation, allowing smaller family-owned farms to retain their independence. The commonality to these modes of organization is the willingness to forego some future upside profit potential in order to guarantee a reasonable, viable minimum price, and the willingness to submit, and this is important, to a certain discipline in production planning. So, whether through concentration, cooperation, or a combination of the two, scale in marketing allows for the pooling of resources to perform essential tasks that cannot be done by individual farmers or company. They're not cost-effective. Most importantly, it helps producers come closer to their final consumer, helping them to better understand their markets, the supply and demand, and to be better able to respond to the needs for new products. Together with concentration, the main markets for livestock have also been characterized by a shift from traditional open market transactions, in other words, spot market, to long-term trading relationships, such as forward contracts, production and marketing contracts, marketing agreements, and downwards vertical integration. These sorts of long-term price agreements are essential tools for price stability. But again, they can only happen when you have correct data on production volume and prices. Know your market and let your market know you. Information is key to sustainability for planning and producing what the market and the consumer wants and not the other way around. Marketing is, in fact, nothing more than the acquisition, proper interpretation, and use of information. Data and analysis are key, and all too often data is poor and analysis is vague. Information is also the key to competitiveness. It's necessary to the formulation of a long-term strategy and vision, to building a market position, to adapting to changing circumstances, and most importantly, to meeting the needs of the consumer. So easy in theory, hard in practice. These basic observations about the principles which drive our industry directed in great part our strategy at my company, Kefalonia Fisheries. It was founded in 1981 by my father-in-law. It's a family-owned business. And it was the first, the oldest aquaculture company in Greece. We were pioneers who had to place great emphasis on research and development, basically because we were learning to produce. We didn't know how. We made large investments in technology, personnel, fixed assets, all directed for production. Sales came as an afterthought. There was a business book written a few years ago titled "It's Not the Big That Eat the Small, It's the Fast That Eat the Slow," whose basic premise is that it's the ability to correctly identify market trends and quickly adapt to them, which represents true competitive advantage in the market. I found this to be absolutely true, and the point was brought home when I first took over management of the company. We were faced with declining prices, heavy debt burden, expensive cost base. And it became clear that any changes we made, no matter how effective in making us more competitive, would only affect our profits 2 years on average later. That's how long our production cycle takes on average. The nature of our production cycle makes our industry highly inflexible and requires heavy capital investment. We make decisions today about investing in production with very little ability to change our plans should the market change by the time our products are brought to market 16 to 24 months later. This early lesson convinced me that flexibility in a highly inflexible industry would represent a true competitive advantage. Investing in know-how, marketing and branding, and keeping close track of market trends. Our industry has traditionally been production-oriented. Production came first, selling came second. For us, it's exactly the opposite. Selling and meeting the customer's demand comes first. Instead of focusing on size and producing a mass-market commodity, we focused on quality and niche markets. First thing we did was started with information gathering about our own corporate identity as well as our real core competence. What was it that made us special, if anything? If there's nothing special or unique about your work, no matter how hard you apply yourself, you won't get noticed. And increasingly, that means you won't get paid much either. The second was identifying what our market was and what it wanted. Because of cost considerations, we couldn't use quantitative data, which turned out to be a great thing. The usual quantitative market surveys will tell you what we have already spoken about. Our market is continuously growing. People are increasingly more healthy, or trying to be. And seafood consumers care about freshness and are concerned about health scares. These are platitudes that don't help you formulate a strategy. Qualitative surveys, focus groups, can help you answer much more targeted questions about your market, your product, and understand much better who your consumer is. One of our main problems, as we've said before, is that we are very far from a final consumer and that our consumers' needs are very different from our customers' needs, the wholesalers that we work with and we compete on price with every single day. The key to effective brand building is communication of a story. Anyone with a checkbook can buy an ad, not just anyone gets written about. Every product and every brand has a story, and the media love telling compelling stories. Communication forces us to focus on what makes us different, newsworthy, talkworthy. In our company, our communication plan is divided into two parts. First of all, we don't have a budget for advertising, nor do we believe that it's effective anymore. Under-the-line marketing is much more persuasive because it's real. If you get an opinion maker to say something about your company or product which turns out to be false, the damage is huge. So under-the-line marketing is basically isolating information about you or your product which is real and interesting. And if you can get this information to the right people, it will grow on its own. We issue press releases, but we never buy press time, as is the norm in Greece. We also never discuss the financials of the company. Why? Because our consumers don't care how much money we're making. The only people who are interested in the only people we're interested in communicating with are our consumers. So two kinds of communication. Addressing the concerns of our potential consumers. We may have the product which solves your problem, addresses your concern. Quality, safety, the environment. The next time they go to the supermarket, they might actually ask for your product. If this starts happening enough time, the retailers will eventually respond. This actually happened to us. And the second is reinforce the purchasing decision of your consumer and your customer. Differentiate between the two. They're both important. But try to foresee potential problems your customer might face and help him be prepared to face them and gain a competitive advantage over his competitor. Form partnerships. Be willing to forego some upside potential to build a long-term relationship. Strategically, you can plan a lot better if you can lock in some minimum revenue. And all of us theoretically know or should know our costs for at least the next production cycle. In our case, 2 years. Tie into emerging trends. Think like a journalist. Green, sustainability, authenticity, sense of place, healthful, artisan farmers. These are all important keywords that are very trendy. I don't want to give the impression that this was all very well thought out since the beginning. It was a process of trial and error which turned out well for us, and luck had a lot to do with it. However, some principles do apply. Gather information to help planning, to know where you're positioned as a company within your industry. Identify yourself and your core competency. Ask yourself this very important question. Can your competitor tell an equally compelling story with as much credibility? And remember, tell the story that is compelling to your consumer. Your consumer does not care if you were the first, the oldest company, how much R&D you have pioneered, or how technologically advanced you are. There is a difference between what your competitors care about, how big you are, the size of your sales, your investments in technology, and what your consumers care about. Our focus is strictly on growing our profits, not our sales. We focused on two key trends, the growing demand for authentic artisanal quality products and sustainable environmentally friendly products. We produce organic sea bass and sea bream, which are sold throughout Europe, Russia, the US, and Canada even. The product is always sold tagged and fresh on ice or frozen and ready to cook in visual packaging. Our packaging has won several awards, notably the European Design Awards in 2008. And I think the numbers speak for themselves. Despite the global economic crisis and our industry's crisis, which has been going on for the last 4 years, we've been able to increase our sales and our net profits by 97%. So, you can never make it too easy to do business with you or too easy to write and talk about your company. Thank you very much.